Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's a Disruption Zone. Representative Savannah Maddox, Kentucky's 61st District, is with us this morning. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm excellent. So what do you and your family do for entertainment during the coronavirus? Have you changed much of your habits or the way that you live your life?
Well, I've been doing a lot of puzzles, playing checkers, and swimming and things like that. I do have two children who are 10 and 8, so we have been using a lot of this time just to do things that we ordinarily might not have had the time to do, including our garden, which has expanded this year over past years, typically just tomatoes, peppers, things like that. But this time we're doing the corn, the beans, and all that sort of thing, hoping to keep the crows out of it.
Did you expand your garden because of the way things happened at the beginning of this, where people were just hoarding everything?
Well, there was a lot of hoarding, but really our expansion was predicated upon the fact that we knew that we would probably have more time to tend to it in terms of getting in between the rows, getting the weeds out. And some of that stuff can be pretty tedious if you're restricted on time. So, right. But, you know, I think that it's important to keep those skills alive, regardless of whether or not we're in a time of economic turmoil or not, just to keep that knowledge base alive and to impart it to my children on how to make your own food, how to grow it, how to harvest it. And also the next step will be how to preserve it in terms of freezing it or maybe even canning it. I haven't decided if I'm going to go down that road yet. That's actually going to require me to consult my parents, who they can stuff, and they've taught me how to do that. But it's serious business, and I think it's important to keep abreast of that stuff.
My mamaw canned. They had, I can remember, so they lived through the Great Depression, and so they had, like, there was a back room in the house that had three or four freezers in it, and they were always full. And they were always full of stuff that were in Cool Whip containers. Do you remember that? That became like the new Tupperware in my mamaw's house. And they just never threw anything away. And they had three large gardens across their property on the back, and everything from corn, green beans, watermelons, she had big, huge apple trees. They were farmers earlier in their life, and later in their life, they just had these three big gardens. And I mean, they had so much stuff. And, you know, I grew up in the desert, so there wasn't any growing a garden in the desert, but it was just awesome to go back to Memal's house and have, you know, green beans and taters that came right out of her garden. There's a different taste. You know, I go to the grocery store now and I get a tomato and it doesn't have any taste.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's very much different. I mean, I grew up at the end of summer, we would be in the back of a pickup truck shucking corn. Some of it would get frozen and, you know, shelling green beans, snapping them. And that's just what we did. And at that point, it was a function of quality. Like you said, it was just better tasting food. And then also, you know, preserving the memory of how to grow things, keep things. And I do think that it's important. And you know what? I realized that at some point it actually became less cost effective to do that, because you can go to the store and, you know, buy a can of green beans on sale for 40, 45 cents or whatever. But I do think that having the memory of how to do that, preserving and being able to be self-sufficient to a certain extent and for a limited amount of time is very important.
Yeah. Well, food without chemicals, too.
Yes, it's like, absolutely.
I love our conversations I have with Congressman Massey about his farm and the way he grows his food and all that. Well, the media in Kentucky loves you. They love you to death. They just think you're the greatest thing since sliced bread, and they love how you support Governor Beshear and all of that. Isn't that fun?
Yeah, it is. And over the past 5 months, it has been a trial by fire to a certain extent, because obviously I am a conservative Republican legislator, and I knew that I would be at odds ideologically with the governor from the time that he was elected. But I don't think that any of us could have anticipated that the coronavirus situation would come to the forefront and that we would enter this realm where we have a governor who is issuing executive orders that are, you know, unnecessarily restrictive of commerce and infringe upon our civil liberties. And, you know, I became very vocal back in March about that. I filed an amendment to KRS-39A. And at that time, you know, with just a little bit over a month of session, the General Assembly didn't move that. But I have become arguably his most outspoken critic on this issue. And it's, again, not something that was predicated upon any type of personal onus that I have towards him as much as it is just his policies and the way that he's handled this, because I do think that we need to be mindful of the fact that the Constitution is every bit as valid during a health crisis as any other time.
Back in May, early May, late April, we were a good 6-8 weeks into this crisis. And I had Senate floor leader David Thayer on.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, you know, I mean, he's basically the second highest ranking Republican in the Senate. And I said, has the governor ever called any of you? And
yes.
We were 6 to 8 weeks in. And his immediate response was no, not once. Now, I don't know that that's changed, but you could probably speak to that. Has the governor at any point ever reached out to the people who represent his constituents across the state to see how maybe some other ideas might come to fore and how to fight this situation?
No, there has been a complete and utter lack of dialogue going back to the time that we were still in session, because at that time, Governor Beshear and also the minority caucus, the Democrats in the House, basically said that we should go home, that we shouldn't even be there, that we would take it back to our communities, meaning the virus and so forth, so on. But not only did he not consult us, but he wanted to prematurely kind of push us out of the equation altogether. And, you know, obviously, with the loan that he got, we found out the $865 million loan that he got from the federal government. We found out about that in a committee meeting. So he didn't notify anybody ahead of time so that we could perhaps develop a plan to pay that off or anything of that nature. And I do recall several months ago that a small group of legislators were notified that Governor Beshear was going to be having a Zoom meeting with them of sorts, and they began gathering questions from their constituents, but he never did it. He did like one or two of them, which granted, I wasn't on the list. I didn't expect to be on the list for obvious reasons. You know, that came as no surprise, but he stops doing it. I mean, it's been a complete lack of transparency. And even in the context of our leadership, House and Senate leadership meeting with him, he is very... he's very adverse to being wrong or to being challenged on any idea, and he does not seem to be amenable to working with others in any aspect of this. So it's been very frustrating.
You know, it's interesting. I can say this because I go back a long way in Kentucky media, and I knew his dad, and mm-hmm. I wasn't a fan of his dad's policies, but his dad was a pretty nice fella. And we got along, and he's not anything like his dad because... you know, politics aside, I've been pushing for eliminating Kentucky's income tax for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to every governor, you know, both Bevin and Beshear about it. And to be honest with you, I got more. Beshear paid more attention to the proposal than Bevin did. Beshear, mm-hmm. original Beshear, Dad Beshear. He actually invited me into his office as a media guy who was pushing for this. And I had sent him my proposal that some legislators had worked on. And I sat down in his office. We had a recorder there. We did a little interview. And he had on his table, on his desk, this is, we're talking about Steve Beshear. He had the folder with the file, and he had handwritten notes in it. He had looked through it. Now, he didn't agree with it, and he didn't do it. But he had the sensibility to... listen to people with whom he disagreed. He'd come on my show and we'd mm-hmm. argue. Andy Beshear seems absolutely different. It's like he does, because if I'm looking at this from a logical standpoint, if I'm a leader, regardless of my politics, I want to know what the constituents throughout the state of Kentucky feel, what challenges they're facing, and what's actually happening in those areas. And the best way to do that is to reach out, regardless of party, to the people who represent those people in those areas, which would be you. It would be the senators and the representatives because of the way the state is broken down. So if you want to know what's happening in northern Kentucky, you want to talk to Savannah Maddox and Koenig's people. You know, you want to talk to those folks and find out what their constituents are saying about what challenges they're facing and maybe some ideas for how they're overcoming those. And he doesn't do
it. No, I agree. And I think that in the greater sense that Governor Beshear's leadership style is very much reflective of the further polarization that we're seeing in partisan politics. I think that he is primarily concerned with the viewpoints of his base, which frankly, that is Lexington and Louisville and some of the further left folks from an ideological standpoint across the Commonwealth. So I'm not sure that he's necessarily interested in input from folks in my district because it is a solidly red, solidly conservative district. And moreover, he also had the benefit for a long time, for several months, of having his daily press conference where he had an hour of earned media, if you will, where he got to espouse his viewpoints and no one could really challenge him on that. And I think that at the onset of this COVID situation, that he was very effectively He was able to effectively use the rhetorical devices of fear and a little bit later, even shame, to convince folks to view these issues the way that he does. But, you know, in the empirical sense, I feel like that has drastically declined. The tides have turned, and obviously a plethora of times, I've lost count now in court, has he been challenged, and it's been determined that his executive orders were unconstitutional for a variety of reasons. So I think that the public opinion has turned quite a bit against him, and like you say, it seems to me at this point that he is scrambling to assert his viewpoint over everyone again, to be right, and I fear that we're going down a road where we're going to actually become more restrictive again, because again, it's predicated on being right. Well, I was right about COVID. I was right about the way that I handled it. And, you know, even the way that the data is manipulated to substantiate his viewpoint, it's just something that I have a great deal of concern about.
Well, give me an example of that.
Well, there are a variety of statistics that have been questioned. And, you know, I am not credentialed in medical science, and I have been very careful to stick to policymaking topics as opposed to foraying into the realm of false positives and mask wearing and so forth, so on. Is it effective? But I do think that it is very evident, you know, just a couple of months ago, whenever he said that children across the Commonwealth would not want to be burdened knowing that by having gone swimming, that they could have killed their elderly grandparents. That's a perfect example of using fear as rhetoric.
Well, hyperbole in place of scientific data. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, obviously there are a multitude of activities that he has not spoken out about, including some of the protests and, you know, even in certain circumstances, activities that border on rioting, frankly.
Right.
And there's the photo that has been going around of him reaching down to an elderly person there at the Capitol with his mask down and having hand-to-hand contact, which, right. You know, I try to avoid really making any type of emphasis on photos or things like that.
Sure,
or his,
because they're moments in time. Yeah, there's not a lot of context
in time
there.
And yeah, I am way more concerned about the documents that he signs his name to and the restrictions that they have on Kentuckians and frankly, the role that I play as a legislator, because, you know, we need to get to a place where we can restore the consent of the governed, because I think that we've lost that, and to also restore an appropriate balance among the three branches of government.
Yeah, there's some interesting statistics and data coming out right now that I'm seeing where one of the things they're doing now that's causing this sort of influx in the increase in cases, one small part of that is people are going back to take elective surgeries now. And when they do, they test them. And when they test them, they have antibodies because they may have over the last several months had it. And that antibodies are showing up as positive, meaning you have people that have already had the virus. They go in for a test for whatever reason. The test shows they have the antibodies, and it's counted as a positive case.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy in Colorado that crashed his motorcycle and died. Happened to have COVID. They listed him as a COVID death. there's a lot of funny stuff going on with the reporting and the data. And then when CNN ran the story, and I want to make it very clear, I support a lot of what the original protests that are going on are about. I think that it is time for law enforcement reform. I do not support rioting. I do not support damage, physical damage, property damage, harming people. But I do support the original idea behind it. However, these mass pouring out into the streets, CNN running an article that's like, there's no way this caused this. However, people going to restaurants did. Come on, man. I mean, people look at that stuff and they go, this is not common sense, right? But I want to come to the masks thing too, because one of the issues, I actually think people should wear masks in closed, confined areas. If you go to the grocery store for 5 or 10 minutes, you should wear a mask. If you're outside, you should absolutely not wear a mask. For one thing, UV light kills it, is my understanding. Number two, as far as I know, there's only been one documented case of transmission person to person outside. It was in China, where two people were talking close together for a couple hours. And then number three, when you're exerting yourself, like outside exercising or even in a gym exercising, ironically, the mask does to you what COVID does. It lowers the blood oxygen levels. So in close contact with fresh masks, you should wear them. But I also don't agree with mandates, because I think Kentuckians can make that decision. I think we can be trusted to make those decisions.
Yeah. And just to circle back to the protest situation, obviously, you know, that's one of the things that I was very concerned about in the beginning, is the fact that this governor had prevented folks from assembling peacefully at the Capitol.
Right.
So, you know, I do absolutely support the right to assemble.
Well, you were the target of the media with
yes,
the protests. And then they turn right around and say, well, your protests were bad, but these are fine.
And that's exactly it. The unequal application of his policies is what I take issue with, because we were told. We had a freedom rally at the beginning of May. I attended, as well as several other legislators, that we were going to get people killed as a result of, you know, the possibility of transmitting this virus, so forth, so on. And yet, whenever folks descended on the Capitol at the protest that Governor Beshear attended, that wasn't an issue, nor were the others. So, I mean, again, it's the unequal application of his policies that I find problematic. And, you know, going back to the mask mandate, the fact that it is a mandate. You know, I think that Kentuckians and Americans in general are capable of making good decisions about what's best for them and their families. And frankly, you know, from a strategic standpoint, I do feel that if Governor Beshear or any of these governors had, you know, said, this is what we need to do, here is the data behind it, here's why, and although the science may not be 100% perfect, this is what we're encouraging you to do. I just personally feel like that would have been received much better than a mandate of sorts.
Right, right.
It's a difficult situation. And with a lot of this stuff, I feel like if it were recommendations at the forefront, people would have been more receptive. But people don't like being told, this is what you cannot do.
Well,
you know, that restriction of liberty.
They were also told originally, don't wear a mask, it doesn't do any good, which didn't make any sense at the time, because they're like, don't wear a mask, it doesn't do any good. Plus, we have to have them for the doctors. And people were like,
well,
what?
Now
they're telling us we need to wear them.
That's why. And I think that has culminated in a certain level of mistrust on behalf of the public, because, you know, the CDC, even the Surgeon General had indicated that we should not wear masks because they were afraid of a run on PPE.
Right.
They wanted to make sure that they had those supplies. And now things are different. The idea, though, that you can take a bandana and expect to have, you know, any level of protection that's on par with an N95 mask, that, you know, there's some inconsistencies there. And I understand that whenever you're talking about statistical data, there's always going to be anomalies, whether it's mask wearing, whether it's in terms of the testing results themselves, because, you know, I have two situations in particular that I'm acutely aware of, where an individual tested positive on a Tuesday, made all the phone calls that you're supposed to make about people that you were in contact with. And, you know, that has a huge ripple effect, too, on businesses, on communities. And then it turns out on Thursday of that same week that it was a false positive and that everything was okay. So, I mean, that, and I also am aware of a circumstance where someone tested negative but was still told by the health department that they needed to quarantine for 10 days and retest. And if they were negative the second time, then they could go about their way because they were involved in a scenario that they were potentially exposed to COVID through contact tracing, so forth, so on. So here again, you have someone that is negative and is being quarantined. So it's
right.
It's very interesting times.
What about this couple that is wearing in wearing ankle bracelets now, apparently here in Kentucky? I don't have the full story in front of me, but apparently they were told they were supposed to quarantine. They weren't following orders, I guess, from the all-powerful state, and now they're wearing ankle bracelets. There was a poll that came out yesterday from, I forget which source had it, but 72% of Americans are okay with fining or jailing people who don't wear masks. Are we in a place where we're in a panic that's right?
That's alarming. Well, and with that particular case out of Hardin County, it's came to my attention, and it was very difficult for me to refrain from commenting and sharing it publicly. And the reason that I did not is because I don't have any of the corroborating documents in front of me to read through the whole case to have the full.
Right. Yeah. I don't want to, I don't know the full details. I mean, obviously if you are positive and you're flouting, we don't want you putting other people's health in danger, but at the same time, this just seems overbearing.
But at face value, I will say this, just at face value on the information that I have, it appears that the woman, it was a woman, a man, and their child, she preemptively decided to go ahead and get tested for COVID because she was going to be traveling out of town and potentially around an elderly grandparent. So again, she took it upon herself to, in her mind, do the right thing, make sure she was good to go, negative, and it came back positive. So at that time, she agreed to quarantine, you know, like you're supposed to, but then the health department came and she refused to sign the documents because she felt that by signing the documents, that one specific part of it said that she would have to get approval from the health department before seeking emergency services. And she didn't feel like that was the appropriate decision for her family. I believe she has a 9-month-old child. So at that point, they slap ankle bracelets on them. And I've even been told that the 9-month child has an ankle bracelet. Again, I can't confirm that, but that's what I've been told. So yes, that it's very disturbing, very concerning. And, you know, I wonder, under similar circumstances, would I want to sign that document? Because I feel like if it were so, myself who tested positive, I would quarantine, of course, but signing over my rights to seek medical care, you know, without hearing from the health department, which frankly, every time that I call some of the cabinets and agencies, it can sometimes take a while for them to get back to you. I can see her concern.
Well,
there.
Okay. So I have to call the government so I can go get that. That's the details that I'm seeing from the story. And again, I just have the Daily Mail story in front of me, but she, like you said, she self-tested, was basically self-quarantining, but wanted to be able to call 911 in case they had a medical issue.
You're having to
without having
permission.
To call the that's insane that our
You're
government
asking,
would work
yes.
that way.
You are asking for permission from the government to be able to get health care that you need in the event of an emergency. So, I mean, that was my issue with it. And obviously, you know, we can talk about this in a bit, but I have Bill Request 130, and it actually does touch on the health department because frankly, the way that the statute is currently constructed, and I don't think that a lot of people realize this, but they have enforcement powers. These are unelected bureaucrats that have the ability to enforce on citizens. And that's something that we should have looked at previously, but it's only come to the forefront as a result of this.
I do want to talk about that because I've only got a few minutes left here. And the main reason I had you on was because you are challenging the governor's authority to do these wide sweeping executive orders that seem to have almost no consultation with other people. What does your bill do and what would it do? What does it fix?
Well, I mean, I look at the problem, first of all. You know, never again can we allow the majority of Kentucky's businesses to be shut down, resulting in the level of economic devastation that we're seeing just by virtue of unilateral decrees. And what BR 130 does is that it says that in the event of a state of emergency, And whenever the governor issues an executive order to that effect, that can only last for a 2-week time frame before the General Assembly is called back into session. And I constructed it in a way that would not require a constitutional amendment because, currently only the governor can call a special session. And getting a constitutional amendment passed is not the most straightforward thing. And I think given the circumstances, it's very imperative that we get this done. So
Right.
more or less, it's 2 weeks from the time that he declare he or she, it's any governor in the future. This, again, isn't specifically targeted at Governor Beshear, that the General Assembly must be called into session to extend that beyond that 14-day window. And it gives the health department in their statute 21 days. For the same, knowing that there are some communicable diseases that the incubation period could transcend that 14-day window. So we wanted to give the health department 21 days and for the executive orders, 14.
Seems common sense to me. It seems like, hey, look, we just want to make sure it's an actual emergency. You've got 14 days, that deals with an emergency. After that, it's not an emergency, it's a situation, and you need all hands on deck.
Yeah, and I mean, there are other stipulations in there. Obviously, it has to be narrowly tailored to meet the exigencies of the emergencies itself. It can't be any broader or burdensome than's necessary. And we also specifically excluded you cannot prohibit religious services in there because one of the things that KRS-39A has right, believe it or not, is that it specifically stipulates that, as it's currently constructed, that you can't prohibit the sales of firearm or ammunition or anything of that nature. And we wanted to go ahead and throw our First Amendment rights in there as well to make sure that it's
Right.
specifically protected. And I've constructed this in a way that I feel like it is the strongest version on the specific time frame, but there are still other aspects of it that I would have liked to have gone even farther. And, in conversations with my colleagues and some of the folks who are co-sponsoring it, I'm hopeful to get the tightest, strongest version of this bill possible to have meaningful reforms come January 2021. And there will be other bills. There already have been pre-filed for various aspects of this situation. But I think the important thing is that we do move forward and we address this because whenever we went out of session back in April of this year, one of the chief complaints that I heard is that the General Assembly can't do anything. People felt like they were left without a voice in this
Right.
situation. So, we don't want that to happen again.
Yeah. Savannah, it's great talking to you again. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right. We appreciate it. We appreciate you standing up for, basically government that isn't done authoritarianly, I guess. Deliberative government. We'll put it that way. Thanks for your time this morning.
Absolutely. Take care.
All right. That is Savannah Maddox, Representative 61st District of Kentucky. All right. Lots to get to. Gosh, I've got some great guests coming up, so keep it tuned here. It is a free podcast. Download it at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and iHeartRadio's app. Just search The Disruption Zone. It'll be delivered straight to your pocket. Fresh new episodes hot out of the oven. Thanks to JP Web Design for their help with the program, as well as my friends Dynamics Productions in Lexington, Kentucky, for their help also. And thank you. Thousands of downloads a week. It's just amazing how quickly this podcast is growing. We are taking off, and it's all because of you. Share it with your friends. I am Leland Conway. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills. You've been listening to The Disruption Zone.